Dear great and holy spirit, be with me now as I do this work. May I be guided by your wisdom, that I may receive comfort and healing and protection, that I may be a vessel of your love. Thank you for this opportunity to love. This is how I go to work in the morning. And it is a great honor and excitement for me to be with you tonight. It's also a little bit too much. And I wouldn't want to do it without some help from friends in high places. I am genuinely amazed at how much I don't know. There are all kinds of things that I truly do not know about. I was about 26 years old when it finally occurred to me that the second hand on the clock was called that because it showed the seconds. I kept wondering why it wasn't the third hand. But I do know about healing. I know about it because of working in the AIDS epidemic for 7 years and working with refugees who have been tortured for the last 2 years. And I'm going to speak to you tonight from my experience. And only from my experience. I want to talk with you about some of the things that need to be present in order for healing to take place. For an individual, for a meeting, for a situation. I speak to you not only as a certified massage therapist and a Quaker healer, but also as someone who has survived rape as a young child. Also someone who survived a family that was ruined by alcoholism and violence. I speak to you as a gay man married under the care of my meeting, living in a world that destroys gay people every day. One of the first things that is needed for healing is surrender. Surrendering to deep feeling. Feeling the depth of sadness and of loss. The depth of terror. Of anger, feeling very, very deeply, more deeply than is comfortable, more deeply than people would like to, ever. That great surrender that all of us have felt at some time in meeting, when we finally saw that thing that we weren't really wanting to look at. Sometimes when an entire meeting saw that thing that was in the way that so many people were able not to see for a long time. So often I feel like I'm sitting in a chair in a corner with my hands over my eyes complaining to God that I can't see anything, you know. Among us are some very sensitive people. And very often these people are called hypersensitive. And when they're not in our presence, we call them hysterical. I tend to be an independent sort of person who goes out and does things on my own. I really am not very good sort of huddling in a group and trying to make group decisions. And when someone gets very sensitive in their thoughts and in their feelings, and they're very sensual in the way they're expressing themselves, part of me wants to say, shut up and roll up your sleeves. But as I have gone along and done my work, I can see very clearly that it is the extremely sensitive people who let us know what's going on deep within ourselves. And I have to keep reminding myself, blessed are the tender-hearted, for they reveal to us our deepest feelings. When people are having hard times, one of the first things that happens is they start to close down in their bodies, in the ways that they move, and in the ways we talk to one another. People actually get smaller in their bodies because times are hard. And the idea of surrendering, of feeling deeply, sounds like leaning into a punch. But it's these very tender-hearted people who are the first to do it. That act of surrender is the first piece of work. Feeling how deeply we are hurt, how much trouble we're in, and feeling deeply how much danger is around us. That's the first work. Always the first work. Because we can't go anywhere without it, without that initial assessment. Are we into it up to our armpits? Yes. Okay. Now that we have that clarity, we can begin some work. Let me sing you a song that I wrote some years ago when I was first beginning to work in the AIDS epidemic. I was looking to put together my rules, the things I needed to remember so that I could go into very painful situations and remember how to make a gift and not take on the sadness and not take on the despair of that situation. The song is called A Little Gracefulness. Sometimes I remember, sometimes I forget. You want to do something wonderful, takes a little gracefulness. It takes a little quiet. It takes a little joy, joy, joy. Takes some believing in good. Takes a little gracefulness to let the love in. Takes a little gracefulness to let it go again. It takes a little sadness and feel in your stuff, stuff, stuff. To feel when way opens takes a little gracefulness. I believe there's plenty. I believe that you care. I believe in me and sun that's always shining somewhere. Experience. The next part of healing is inviting angels. I have a sense that each of us has some friends in high places, and I don't go to work without them. I really don't. And I think all of us has friends. All of us have friends all around us all the time. It's very important during hard times to sit still and say, if you would please be so kind, I need some more understanding. I need some more patience. Maybe I need a little bit more time. Very often trouble comes in the form of sort of like a life quiz, you know? It's like, it's almost a little bit like playing tennis. You know, they hit the ball at you and it's coming down over here. And what do you know about getting the racket over here to get the ball back to the other side, you know? Okay, I'm sending you this trouble. What do you know? What do you know about doing life? And when we don't know enough, we can say, excuse me, about this quiz you sent. I know this is the second time I flunked it. Could we like do the lesson again? A little bit? Once? Slower? I have an image of my angels, sort of like my great uncles and aunts, sitting around a card table up on a cloud. And they're sitting around, and one of them says, I know, let's get him ready to do this thing over here. And another one says, oh no, he's not ready for that. Look at him. Look what happens to him when he doesn't find parking in front of the laundromat. He's not ready for that big thing over there. If you're going to invite your angels, it calls for a certain level of softness. When I began doing my work, I really did not have very much idea or faith in angels. And then one day I was working with a healer, a wonderful woman by the name of Jean Schweitzer, who could look into your body like looking into a milk bottle. And she said, well, now you have some very big angels with you and you can always ask for help. And one day too much work came to me. and I really was not ready to do the work that came to me. But it was very much like fishes and loaves, because the energy that I needed to do what was being asked of me, of three people, one right after another, who were in very big trouble, all that I needed came to me so that I could make a beautiful gift to them. And then I sat down in meditation and prayer and I said, now see here, what is going on? I don't understand what is going on. I don't really believe in angels, but I could sort of feel you there, so I wish you would show up and talk to me, because I'm going down this road in a way that I don't understand. The angels wouldn't show up until I cried. They really wouldn't show up until I felt the depth and the deep quiet that one needs to hear angels. And some angels came right through and they said, now see here, we're going to get a lot of work done. Well, what am I supposed to do? All you have to do is stay soft. In your tenderness, you can receive these gifts and you can give them to others. And you must invite us. Let me sing you a song by the name of Carry and Burn. I wrote it a while ago when I was up in Vermont hauling firewood. The song came to me when I was looking at the reality that as someone who is making a gift of healing, my work is identical to the person who I'm working on. Everyone who is looking to be of help and everyone who is a helper are involved in the same task, being as graceful and as wise as they can be in a situation which is organized against grace and wisdom. Carry and burn, carry and burn. This firewood I gather to carry and burn. And my love is the same. Oh, my love is the same. We gather and gather to carry and burn. I'm afraid of the fire. It will change me, I know. What will be left when I pass through of the me I know now, what will be new? Like any love, it undresses you and gives too much and asks more than you have. And the view from here, and the view from here is more, more than one chooses. Let me talk a little bit about receiving messages. Something I have always been very reluctant to do, because you know it's going to mean more work. When I first began to receive what I understood to be clear messages, I had a great deal of reluctance to hear them. I thought, well, now I'm just a nice working class Italian-American kid, and I really would prefer not to do anything too new agey or too old fashioned. But if voices get loud, they get loud. When people are having hard times, when a meeting is having a hard time, and people want to get up and do something, people want to get up and change something, people want to get up and blame other people, it is even more important to sit down and be quiet and to listen very carefully and try not to hear yourself. Now, messages are very sneaky things. They come in ways that you don't expect. I imagine just about everybody here has bumped into some large thing as a very clear message to slow down. Once upon a time, I was in a thrift store, and I saw an entire rack of ancient suitcases. And all of a sudden, I knew I was supposed to buy some of them. And here I am standing in the Salvation Army, having an argument with God. And I said, now, what do I need with 6 antique Samsonite suitcases? I mean, really. I do not have enough money to fill up the car with gas. I'm not going anywhere. But it was a clear message, and I couldn't deny it. I didn't even have a place to put 6 suitcases. But I bought them and I took them home. And they sat there, and I looked at them. And I said, what are you for? What are we supposed to do? I had been doing my work for about a year and a half. And within a month or so, I began to receive invitations to travel, to go and teach about my work, to go into situations where organizations are working in crisis, sanctuary work, prisons, rape crisis center, AIDS organizations, and teach how a person can go into a situation that looks hopeless and make your contribution and bless it and let it go. And go and rest and come back full so you can do more and not take on the despair of the situation. I now have 20 suitcases. And I'm on the road about 3 or 4 months of the year. I do lots of traveling. Just about every time before I was supposed to take a big trip, I would find a new suitcase that I was supposed to buy. The last time I bought a big suitcase was just before I met Marshall. And I thought, oh, I must be going on a big trip. I certainly was. But messages also come in ways that are not funny and in ways that scare you. And let me tell you about one of those times for me, a time that was very, very hard to listen. It was about 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago. It was in March. Marsh and I had just moved to Washington, D.C. from Los Angeles. And we were very happy. We were very happy together. And he said to me after we'd gotten moved in, my armpits feel achy. And he was thinking that maybe that it was from the moving and so much lifting. Marshall didn't know anyone at that time with AIDS. But I knew that one of the first signs of AIDS very often is a swelling of the lymph nodes. And I very calmly turned to him and said, "Oh, how long have they been bothering you?" "Oh, about a week." "Well, let's go see a doctor. It's important. Let's go see a doctor." Before we got to the doctor, I sat down in prayer. No, it wasn't really prayer. I sat down in fury. I said, "How dare you? How dare you? Don't you dare threaten me like this. I go through all of these fires. I hand over my life to do this work. And you send me this love, this person who I love more than anyone else in the world. I thought we had a deal. Don't you remember that day I looked up in the sky and I said, 'You've given me all these gifts, but you haven't sent me a lover. I think I can deal with that. But you should send more money.'" "I thought we had an understanding, and now you're doing this. If this man is hurt, I quit the company. I'll get a new boss. I'm out of here." I was furious, furious. And always the message came back, "Feel this. Feel this deeply." So we went to the doctor. And we took the HIV antibody test. And it took a week for the results to come back. And in that week, I came around to a place of saying, "All right, all right, I'm sorry I threatened you. But now I will tell you the truth. If you hurt this man, if this man suffers, and you take him from me, my heart will be broken. And I will not be able to do this work anymore. I cannot go out on this limb and see this suffering that I see and have people's pain pass through me because I will be so full of my own." And the message kept coming back. "Feel this deeply." We both tested negative for the virus, and all that was needed was a little medication for a bacterial infection. And the next week I was invited to begin my work with Comadres of El Salvador to work on refugees who have been tortured. And I said, "Oh, feel this deeply. Feel what it's like to have the person you love most in the world threatened, maybe taken away, and your own life endangered. Feel this deeply, because now I give you opportunity to go and work with people who live with this every day, who have memory of the things that people fear most in the world. That themselves and the people that they love most in the world will be hurt beyond all that can be imagined. Let me sing you a song that I wrote. When I began to work with comadres, I had a hard time finding refugees who had been tortured to work on. I went to Amnesty International, and I didn't say I was a healer because I know that scares people. I said I was a massage therapist, which I am. And they sent me over to the Guatemalan Physicians Health Task Force. And they sent me over to the Hispanic Mental Health Clinic, and they sent me over to the Mayor's Office on Latino Affairs. And I thought, well, this is not working, so I called up a good Catholic communist friend of mine. And I said, Mary, you know what I do. Can you find me someone to work on? She said, let me make a few calls. And in a day or two, I was down at the office of Comadres, and here was this beautiful, strong, little brown woman, Maria Tula. And her husband had been murdered, and she had been abducted and tortured twice, gang raped by the soldiers. When she was 7.5 months pregnant, and part of her torture was to have a knife scored along her belly with them threatening to take her baby from her. And she later had that baby in prison. When the international outcry arose that one of the founders of Comadres was in prison being hurt, President Duarte came forward and brought her out of prison and held a press conference and said, you can see she's perfectly well. We have dropped all of the charges against her. We see that she is perfectly innocent, and you can see that we have democracy here in El Salvador. And Maria marched up to the microphone. And she said, I was tortured by this general right over here. She made her way to the United States. She was helped across the border by Quakers. And I sat down with her, and through a translator, I said, Maria, I have a big spirit following me, and sometimes when I touch people, they stop hurting. And they sleep better, and their sadness leaves them. And her eyes got very big. And I thought, she's looking at me to see if I'm crazy. And she said, it would be very beautiful if you could make this go away. When can we start? And we've been working for 2 years now. And this is a song that just came out the other day as I was driving along. It's called Maria. Sí, Maria, isn't she lovely? See her watching her children as they play, looking in their eyes. She sees tomorrow. Sí, Maria, isn't she lovely? See, Maria, strong and brave, what the soldiers did to her, it breaks my heart to say. Now she tells the story in all of our our churches, and the soldiers keep killing, and we know who pays them. Maria, Maria, Maria del Salvador, if they send her back, we'll all die a little, a little, a little. I want to share one more idea with you. And really, I think of everything that I have had a chance to experience, this is the most important. For every person, for every situation that is looking to get well from trauma, from hurt, from some sort of serious hard time, there is something common to all of these. It is the dance between hope and fear. And it goes on for every person who's looking to get well. On the one hand, you have fear. This thing that we learn as we go through life and we bump into something and we're afraid we're going to be hurt again. And it's very pushy, very loud, and aggressive. You can hear it in people's voices all the time. It's learned. It's not original equipment. And it's very logical, following hard times, following a time when you've been hurt deeply. And over here we have hope. Beautiful, beautiful hope. Which is not a very well understood idea in our culture. It's confused with wishing. Hope is a very specific idea. It's a very old word. Its original definition is the desire for goodness with the expectation that it can be achieved. That's very powerful. And everyone has hope. The child turning to suckle is not an idle act of survival. It is the desire to thrive, to be in the world. That's an act of hope. Children coming into a classroom with so many questions as to how does the world work? Why do we do it this way? And what do we call that over there? Why did they put the lake at the bottom of the hill? Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. It was much easier than carrying all that water up here. Hope is a passion, and everyone has lots of it. Everyone has all that they need to do the work that's in front of them. Let me tell you one story about hope to show you how absolutely strong it is. One day I was doing massage on a fellow named Michael. He was very ill with AIDS. He was close to dying. And he said, are you working on anyone else this week? I said, yes, I'll be working with Sabina. Oh, what's going on for her? Well, 15 or 20 years ago, someone came and stole Sabina's youngest child and murdered her. And that sadness now is in her back, and her back hurts. And when we work, she grieves that loss, and the pain goes away. And Michael said, oh my God, I could never deal with anything like that. And later that week, I was working with Sabina. And she said, are you working on anyone else this week? I said, yes, I'll be working with Mary Alice. Oh, what's going on for her? Well, about a year ago, on one very, very bad morning, she was raped at knife point, shot by a rifle, and then blown up by a bomb, all in a couple of hours. And Sabina said, oh my God, I could never deal with anything like that. And then I was working with Mary Alice later that week, and she said, are you still helping that poor man with AIDS to die? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, I could never deal with anything like that. You see, because hope is so strong, we can each of us deal with a lot of things. It's just that no one wants to volunteer. Hope is very, very strong. It's a passion. And everyone has piles of it. The problem is it gets covered over by discouragement and pain and all these other things. But hope is very strong, and hope has a very particular job in healing. Some sort of monster has shown up. The you-know-what has hit the fan, and now we are in trouble. We're hurting, or there's great danger, or there's some sort of trauma going down for a person or a group or an organization or something. And fear says, aha, you see, I told you there were monsters out there and you weren't being careful. And now I'm sitting down to the driver's seat and we're going to have some rules. We're not going out at night. We're going to sit up straight. We're going to fold our hands. We're not going to say too much. I'm in charge. And that's fear. Pushy. Very logical. And it closes all the doors and the windows to protect us from a monster. It closes all the same doors and windows that our goodies come through. All the things that nourish our spirit and our bodies. And hope comes over and says, now fear, I understand why you're doing this. I saw the monster too. And I know that there were damages. But frankly, you have made life so small, I am bored to tears in here. Could we open up a window? Could we draw the drape? Could we come out from under the futon for just 5 minutes and stop screaming? Could we go for a walk, see a friend? Have some ice cream, a little something. I need something here. We need more space in here. We need some light. We need some fresh air. And that's the job of hope. To lobby within the legislature of the heart for space. To come over to fear, who is trying to run the entire show. And rattle the armor and say, I think we can crack a window and sneak in some goodies here. The place we see this most often, is when someone close to us dies. And you have a friend who's sort of a good friend, but not a really good friend, and you're telling them what happened. And you talk to them about your sadness. But it's just talking, it's just telling the story. And then you have a very good friend, someone who you trust, someone whose love you find credible. And they come and sit with you and you tell the same story. And the next thing you know, you are a puddle of tears, swept away by your grief. That's your hope, saying, aha, so-and-so is in town, we can let it rip. This dance between hope and fear goes on. That's why the nature of healing is cyclical. None of it happens all at once. There's trauma, and people do some initial work to assess the damages and see what needs doing. They make some decisions and they take some actions, and then comes around a time to rest. And that rest is very important. And then comes time to do some work again, to take another assessment of the damages, take another look and see what needs doing, and then make some more decisions and take some more actions. Hope comes over just every once in a while. It doesn't do it all the time. You can't do your work all the time. It's too hard. It's too hard to do your healing work all the time. You have to rest. And the rest is just as important as the work. They go together. And that's very true for those of us who are looking to be of help to other people, as well as those of us who are looking to be of help to ourselves. That dance between hope and fear is going on all the time for everyone who's looking to get well. And if you watch very carefully in yourself and in your meeting, you will see that there is a moment, some time, some place, where hope shows up. And that's the time to give it vitamins. That's the time to encourage it with our tenderness and with our truth and honesty. Let me sing you one last song. Let me get the guitar here. Can you hear that?
Rose looks out from her blanket, and she wonders how she'll get through the day. You see, Tommy died last summer. She's afraid she'll never laugh again. Now she could take her own life or stick around and see what's next. She looks out on another new day. She says, good morning, dawn. It's so good to see you today. Hello, sun, it's me again. Do you think you could come out and play?
Let's try that chorus together. You've been sitting here sweating, listening to me. Why don't you sing with me here? Hello, dawn. Well, wait, I don't really know the words till I'm singing it. I only wrote it 2 years ago and I don't know it yet.
And she said, good morning, dawn. It's so good to see you today. It's me again. Do you think you could come out and play?
Wonderful.
Carlos looks out at the old car he's been sleeping in, and he smiles just to be alive. He's lost everything but a little joie de vivre that he keeps in what's left of his mind. Now he and the sun have come round again. He looks out at this old friend and says, he says, good morning, dawn. It's so good to see you today. Hello, sun, it's me again. Do you think you could come out and play? Tom was surrounded by shining, and he felt himself drifting away. The moment he died, the journey began, and he wonders if he'll come round this way. Now he'll miss this old world, but that body was hell. He looks into the light and he says, good morning, dawn. It's so good to see you today. Hello, sun, it's me again. Do you think you could come out and play? Life begins again, and the joy and the pain and the beauty and the sorrow come swirling round everyone's way. Oh, what will you say when tomorrow comes around? And what did you say today? Did you say good morning, dawn? It's so good to see you today. Hello, sun, it's me again. Do you think you could come out and play?
I am so grateful to be with you this week. I'm so grateful to all of the many people who work so hard to bring this gathering together, who work for years for each gathering. I'm so grateful to the people who brought the NAMES Project AIDS Memorial Quilt to FGC this year. If you haven't seen it yet, don't miss it. It's going to be open till 10 tonight, and it's going to be open from 9 to noon tomorrow. It is stunning. I'm so grateful to all the people who made it possible to bring it here, especially John Meyer and Lyle Jenks. They worked very hard to get such a big project on the road. The prayer that I opened with is the prayer that I use every time I do some work on someone. And when I finish a piece of work, I stand back and I say, dear great and holy Spirit, please wash me. Thank you for this opportunity for loving. And please keep me ready for more.